thought how your own biases are steering your decision-making. We all like to think that we are rational people and that we make decisions based on objective facts. But the truth is that biases have profound consequences on the choices we all make. Investors are no exception. In this podcast, we'll explore how bias affects the decisions of investors and how we can use tools and strategies to turn this knowledge to our advantage. I am Anna Pavlova, professor of finance at London Business School and an academic director of the AQR Asset Management Institute. The insights you're about to hear are from our Insight Summit, addressing behavioral biases in investing. Nobel laureate Robert Shiller was our keynote speaker, and more academic insight came from Nicholas Barberis from Yale School of Management and Madan Pilutla from London Business School. The event brought together global leaders in academia, industry, and policymaking with asset managers from AQR, JP Morgan Asset Management, Fidelity, and NN Investments. They were joined by consultants from Willis Towers Watson and Stanford Associates. Executives from pension funds Railpen, Nest, and Axia, and the Financial Conduct Authority also took part in the exchange of ideas. We hope what you're about to hear will inspire industry best practices now and for many years to come. First, Nicholas Barberis from Yale School of Management talks about the main biases identified in behavioral finance, starting from overconfidence.
This idea of overconfidence has several applications in finance, but perhaps the principal motivation for invoking it in the financial context is to understand the very high trading volume we've observed in financial markets for decades. Non-speculative motives for trading, like liquidity needs or rebalancing, are unlikely to explain that much of all this trading volume. Instead, it seems that most trading is likely speculative, in other words, based on people's differing beliefs about future price changes. And the key point is this, and this was only really figured out in the 1980s, is that it's hard to generate a large amount of speculative trading in an economy where everyone is fully rational. If I go to buy a stock, and then you are willing to sell to me, well, if I'm fully rational, I'm then going to say, wait, why are you willing to sell to me? Perhaps you know something bad about the future prospects of this company. In which case, you know what? I think I'd rather not buy after all. Now, that might sound extreme to you, but that is how a fully rational person will think. When we write down models of fully rational investors, we find that they don't predict a lot of volume for this reason, nothing like the amount of volume you observe in the real world. And I guess the point is that overconfidence is a nice way of breaking this logjam. Let me repeat the story with some overconfidence thrown in. I go to buy a stock, you're willing to sell to me. So then I say to myself, okay, why are you willing to sell to me? Oh, okay, you think you know something bad about the future prospects of the company. But then I say, I don't care what you think, because I think I'm much better than you at analyzing stocks, and you feel exactly the same about me, and so we're both very happy to trade with one another. We both think we're on the winning side of the trade. Obviously, we can't both be, but because of overconfidence, we think we are, and therefore we're happy to trade.
Nicholas's message here is plain. A lot of trading behavior is irrational. So what should we be doing about it? The fact is, our biases are so ingrained that they are resistant to most efforts to squash them. London Business School's Madan Pilutla has argued that incentives and training have very little impact on our biases. However, there is one method that does hold some promise. It's called frugal heuristics, and it's at the forefront of current research.
There is a literature that's out there that deserves a lot more attention than it is getting today. It's a literature that grew out in the 1990s and mostly associated with a German psychologist by the name Gerd Gegerenzer, and he calls this the fast and frugal approach. The idea is behind this kind of research is really that when we think about heuristic, when we think about rules of thumb that people are using, it doesn't always lead to biased decisions. Because a lot of times, the heuristics and the rules of thumb have, like, you know, so evolution has equipped us with these rules of thumb. So in a lot of different domains and across, like, you know, different, it generalizes across domains, the use of these, like, frugal, these kind of heuristics, it leads to good and effective kinds of decisions. The second kind of assumption behind this is that it's not just evolution, it's through experience also that we can develop some of these heuristics. And what we find problematic in the way that people make, like, statistical inferences and so on, it goes away if we align the way that we present information to people, which is consistent with the way that the brain has trained itself or the brain has evolved to process information. So if you, like, present information in that fashion, or if you can train people in that fashion, that would result in better outcomes.
So it seems there is a lot of work to be done to understand how our brain processes information before we can work out how to effectively overcome our biases. But that hasn't stopped some asset managers from using behavioral finance techniques to improve their performance. Michael Barakas of JP Morgan is one of them.
The key to our success over the last 20 years in driving very strong returns for clients has been to structure our investment process, our investment decision-making process, in a way that tries to prevent us allowing our own emotions to lead to biases in decision-making. So if you break it down into stock selection, portfolio construction, implementation, you know, stock selection, you've got to be really focused rigorously in a very disciplined fashion on only really looking at the kind of stars in the market that are empirically proven and not getting swayed by what I would argue is the majority of information out there, which is noise, which can lead to improved confidence of decisions, but not improved accuracy.
In that case, might active managers who use behavioral investment techniques have the upper hand in a bear market? Barney Rowe from Fidelity thinks so.
I'm more cautiously optimistic about the efficacy of sort of, you know, behavioral investment techniques than I am about the performance over the markets over the next couple of years. I think, you know, one way of looking at what an active manager, you know, active managers obviously bring a lot of skills to investing, but one area where they ought to have an advantage over, you know, pure passive or simpler sort of smart beta strategies is an understanding market behavior and market sentiment. And if you look at the Thomson Reuters, you know, the Lipper data, the fund data, it is a fact that active funds tend to do better in bear markets and struggle more in bull markets. Mm-hmm. And I think that makes intuitive sense. When the emotions are running higher, I think that just seems intuitive. So I think, you know, given that I'm not forecasting those patterns of fear and greed to disappear anytime soon, I think there's still a lot of opportunities where behavioral investing will work.
It seems that both investment techniques have their place in the market. Some firms are even combining the two and using human brain power together with computers to help correct for behavioral biases. Evout van Schaik of NN Investment Partners explains.
You cannot improve your biases if you're not fully aware. I think the distinctive feature in our process, maybe compared to some others, is that not only do we combine fundamental analysis with behavioral analysis, we also try to combine man and machine. And personally, I'm always very much surprised by the fact that behavioral science is a pretty quantitative science. It has become a quantitative science, which actually is weird because if you think about the market from the behavioral perspective, a lot of the assumptions underlying the efficient markets are put aside. Hey, you don't believe in rational investors. You don't believe in all the preconditions for rational markets. At the same time, a lot of the quantitative tools that are applied to apply the behavioral science theories do use the same assumptions like normal distributions and a lot of other modeling assumptions. So we try to combine always the techniques with your own human intelligence, and that means that it's quant plus qual in our process.
It's a view supported from an asset management perspective too. Michael Barakas explains why there is a power in this combination that adds up to more than the sum of its two parts.
I think all of us are advocating for the fact that combining a quantitative or computer modeling approach with that, you know, expert fundamental approach, the two together, it definitely feels superior to us than any one of the individual parts. And again, in academic literature, if you look at Mabusin and what he did around looking at freestyling chess, if you look at weather forecasting over the years and how much that's significantly improved by combining the best of computer modeling with expert knowledge, that's definitely a much more effective approach in terms of generating better predictions, better forecasts in our industry, better returns ultimately, but also doing it in a better risk-controlled manner as well, rather than having that error maximization at the extreme from any one of the individual approaches.
It's clear that awareness of bias plays a large part in the investment processes of these asset managers, and that harnessing this awareness and combining it with machine learning may give them a distinct advantage over those who don't. Marcos Lopez de Prado from AQR tells us more about machine learning and how it can assist behavioral finance through textual sentiment analysis. He also delves into how we can use bet sizing to mitigate probability neglect. And remember the flash crash of May 2010? Marcos argues that machine learning, which analyzes exponential patterns, can help at times when human emotions run high.
You may remember the flash crash of May 6, 2010. Around 11:56 a.m., there was a very negative imbalance order flow. By 1:08 p.m. Eastern time, the order flow imbalance was already in the 95th percentile. It was one of the most imbalanced periods in history in terms of order flow. By 2:32, the crash begins, and it lasts something like 3-5 minutes before it stops and then slowly recovers. So the microstructural process that was underneath this phenomenon was in fact behavioral, in the sense that what happened is, as market makers received toxic order flow and they were forced to liquidate their inventory, these market makers became liquidity consumers. And as these market makers became liquidity consumers and pressed the market further down, these injected fear in the remaining market makers. Eventually, all market makers were gone. There was nobody standing on the bid. The price collapsed 10%, and high-frequency traders kick in because, you know, at the 10% discount, who doesn't want to be on the buy side? Now, this is a microstructural phenomenon, but what made it possible was that humans back off, pull out of the market, and what stopped the crash was cold machines bidding once the market collapsed 10%, the high-frequency traders. These machines were not biased. These machines just saw an opportunity and enter without fear, and that's why we talk today about a flash crash as opposed to a 1987-style crash.
It's comforting to see machines being used to stabilize the market. It underlines how earlier crashes, like the one in 1987, were driven by human fear and lack of rationality. So far, we've looked at the biases of supposedly sophisticated investors, but the whole industry is underpinned by decisions taken by the end consumer, the man on the street, who has to make initial decisions about their fund selection. Regulators are concerned that the public aren't making the best decisions and that the industry isn't giving them the right products. Do you know that many consumers tend to ignore charges when choosing a product and diminish their returns as a result? Paul Adams from the FCA told us how charges are so easily overlooked when purchasing financial products and why this might be.
When charges make such a big difference to returns, why do people fail to take them into account? So one explanation could be limited attention. So Barber, Odin, and Zheng argue that investors are sensitive to what is traditionally used in marketing, such as past performance, and insensitive to price, especially backloaded fees. And recall that our own work on search behavior suggests that consumers rarely actively search for charges. A second possibility could be that consumers do not understand the effect of compound interest and therefore ignore charges, thinking they're not important for returns.
Over the long term, the effects of compound interest are certainly startling. Should the frugal heuristics mentioned by Madan earlier be used to improve the decision-making process for the consumer? Let's look at the bigger picture of optimizing investment performance again. Luba Nicolina, Global Head of Manager Research at Willis Towers Watson, who advises large investors on the best places to allocate their money, said when it comes to investment success, the culture of a team is key.
behaviors determine culture of asset management organizations, and culture determines behaviors of people who work in those organizations. But if you were to ask me what is one key critical success factor that helps us differentiate future winners from future losers in the investment world, my answer will be culture.
So what are the individual characteristics that make a good portfolio manager? More consultant insight comes from Adrian Furnham of Stanford's Associates.
Curiosity. I think curiosity is the single best predictor of intelligence and staying alive. It's a very attractive characteristic in human beings. I'm interested in their curiosity about all sorts of things. That is a good measure. There are others as well. Quirkiness, adaptability and flexibility, honesty and integrity. And we've got, along this, we have 12 of these characteristics now, and we have ways of assessing people of them.
It looks like those one step removed from the investment process take a more qualitative approach to assessing performance, possibly because they're looking at the bigger picture. But whether we take a wider view of a situation or focus on the tiny details, there is one thing we're all highly influenced by: narratives. Nobel laureate Robert Shiller finished the day by talking about the influence of narratives on our investment behavior. Narratives have only recently become possible to study in a meaningful way with access to big data. But according to Shiller, they have an enormous influence on our biases and spread in a similar way to a contagious disease. As with a disease, the popularity of a narrative has a bell shape where it slowly develops, peaks, and eventually dies off. This also applies to the popularity of economic theories, the profile of public figures, or more spurious, factually incorrect narratives.
The topic is what drives the economy. If it isn't rational expectations, what is it? And in this analysis, I try to be as eclectic as possible, not just relying on narrowly interpreted behavioral finance, which would mean psychology department methods, but methods from all the social sciences and beyond the social sciences, medical epidemiology. When I'm talking about these theoretical models, I'm talking about sophisticated economists, but more important are the epidemics with the general public of silly or weak theories or stories. But one example of this is the so-called Laffer curve. In 1974, economist Arthur Laffer had dinner with Jude Wanniski and Dick Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld, who were high up. Cheney became vice president of the United States. Wanniski was a writer for the Wall Street Journal, and he wrote a book called The Way the World Works in 1978. And he was a skilled narrator. He didn't just describe economic theories. He put them in a story form that would make them contagious to the general public. So the story that Wanniski told was a story of that dinner. Wanniski said that during dinner, Art Laffer pulled out a napkin and drew this diagram, which was a relationship between tax rates on income and tax revenues. And he said it should be hump-shaped because if the tax rate is either 0 or 100, there will be no revenue. No one will earn any income if the tax rate is 100%. But in between, there will be some revenue, so there must be hump-shaped. But what that means is that there's always two different tax rates for any desired amount of revenue, either A or B. But obviously, you should pick the lower tax rate. He raised the possibility that the higher tax rate is what we've been doing, which is destructive. Now, this is an economic theory, but it's presented as part of a story. And the story went viral, and it had big effect. I think it had some effect, at least, on the Thatcher election, which made her prime minister, and then a year later on the Ronald Reagan conservative election. These were both tax cutters. It implied that you could cut taxes and have no bad effects, really good effects.
Whether we are predicting the markets or voting in an election, we're being swayed by information that creates an inaccurate picture. In this era of fake news, the need to admit this to ourselves is more pressing than ever. Has the stage been set for a rapid growth in our understanding of our behavioral biases? Will we be able to use this understanding to more effectively control markets and enhance investment techniques? The truth is, we don't know. But we do know that with access to technology, we can make progress in this area like never before. We live in volatile and uncertain times, but they're exciting too. For more content like this, visit our website, london.edu.